Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
This is Greg Hutchins. Most of the time I forget my name, but hi, Fred. How are you doing?
Good, good. Yeah, as a complete aside, as we're recording it, this is the first week of a course that I'm teaching through University of Maryland, and I've been teaching it for years and years, actually 20 years. And so I'm getting to know the new students and getting started and all this stuff. And I'd say 3/4 of them so far, when I asked them a little bit about them and, you know, what they're hoping to get out of the course, they would respond back, even though I said in my welcome message, just address me as Fred. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a professor. Just Fred is fine. You don't need to have to learn how to spell my last name, you know, that kind of stuff. I just 3/4 still address me as professor or as Dr. Schenkelberg. And I'm like, I don't know who Dr. Schenkelberg is. I'm sure there is one in the world someplace, but it ain't me. And it's like, but anyway, it's been fun with getting to know the students and all that good stuff. But, you know, how you get addressed is, I don't know. Some were like, well, why don't you want to be called professor? Because I'm not one. Besides, I want you to relax. This is, you're not being given an exam, whether you follow my rules or not. You know, it's not that set up. But anyway, I digress. And a couple of them were surprised that there was a textbook. Like, it's like, wait a second, you're a graduate student and you didn't go look for what book is, you know, required for this course. But anyway,
is it my turn to digress?
Oh yeah, go for it.
So anyway, I'm a big believer in lean, always have been, mm-hmm. You know, it's just like, you know, one of my religions. So, you know, this is the Fred and Greg show, and I know that I'm the second banana, so it's always Fred first. But what's common between those two names? It's monosyllabic names, Fred, one syllable, Greg, one syllable.
Well, I don't know if your parents named you Gregory, because my parents named me Frederick, so...
Well, we had a daughter, you know, years ago, and I wanted to have a monosyllabic name for my daughter. I didn't mm-hmm. want to keep on saying Frederick or Gregory, right? Mm-hmm. That's like how many syllables, 3 or 4. Yeah. And, you know, I don't have time to say that a million times. So anyway, I wanted to be lean in naming my kid. So with my wife, we said, if it's a guy, it's going to be Zed or Fred.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
If it's going to be a girl, it's going to be Marge.
Well, yeah, you compromised.
Marge became Margot. And of course, what type of Margot? Not M-A-R-G-O, but Margot as in French Burgundy.
It's funny about all that stuff. But, and you never know. Some kids, you name them a real fancy name, and then they get called Butch or Buster or something like that. You know? I ran into an article a couple weeks ago, and it made me think of an event back when I was at HP, and it's related to the title of the podcast on risk detection or risk monitoring, I should call it. And by risk monitoring, I mean that you have some sensory systems or data tracking systems, or you have some apparatus or framework to detect if something you perceived as a risk that you need to respond to. I mean, you can always detect a risk. That's not an issue. But the ones that you identified for the organization that, yeah, we want to know about this as early as possible when we can do something about it. So I think that's what I mean by risk monitoring. It's not looking for everything. It's looking for specific things. And when I was at Hewlett Packard, one of the things we routinely looked for, and we didn't have any real fancy system or monitoring or, you know, structure set up, at least at where I was, is there a major issue that's going to affect multiple organizations, different product lines, warranty. And so if there was like some kind of either design error or component problem from a big vendor or some manufacturing disruption from one vendor that was causing defects that would get to customers. And then it would, you know, and in some cases we've had them that would double our field failure rates. And when you're spending $1 billion a year on warranty expenses, because it is the size of the company and the nature of the products, doubling it ended up being material, mm-hmm. as you like to say. So it was more something that we were kind of always looking for so we could get ahead of it and keep it from becoming material. And I mean, is that what you would define or describe risk monitoring as?
So, you know, quality monitoring, I mean, these are broad terms and you can mm-hmm. always come up with exceptions. Quality monitoring to me has always been looking at the past. Risk monitoring is looking at the future. Mm-hmm. Now, again, those are, you know, you can come up with exceptions to that. And basically,
I guess the way I described it would be more quality monitoring, because but it didn't always turn out that way. It wasn't always they were reacting to field problems. We may have known about a manufacturing got moved from one place to another, and we'd get ahead of it.
The important thing is responding, not reacting. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a change in language, but it's also a change in thinking, framing, and looking at the problem. So in SPC, statistical process control, you know, you could have trend lines. You know, I'm not going to give you an example. I'm assuming that most of the folks listening know what an SPC chart looks like.
Yeah.
You got patterns, you got trend lines, and you can basically, you know, anticipate something in the future happening. But this is an interesting thing. We work with AI systems now. AI systems can look at huge amounts of data in the past, look for trend lines, anomalies.
Oh, you take five samples and average it, yeah.
Yeah, signal the noise, and then basically project that in the future. So, and then you do a CAPA, corrective action, preventive action. Mm-hmm. From our point of view, in terms of risk monitoring, we look at four factors. And as a matter of fact, we even trademarked this because this was so prevalent in what we do. We want to be proactive, preventive, predictive, and preemptive. Think about that, the four Ps. Mm-hmm. We want to be proactive, meaning we want to have a system in place, a process in place that not only looks at the past, but looks at the future, what can happen, right?
Well, then that's, the risk identification piece, I would think.
Exactly right. And then we want to be able to predict and then prevent things from possibly happening and then hopefully have some smarts in the system that basically is preemptive, okay? You know, if there's a pattern, we can see it early on and then basically preempt the problems from occurring or the risks occurring.
Yeah, and that, I mean, SPC, statistical process control,
yep.
kind of fits all of those things. It's absolutely. Much more discrete though, right? It's on a product or on a product line or on a production line is where you commonly see it. And you're sampling or automatically measuring stuff and you're looking for those out of control signals that say, oh, something's up here. And oftentimes the reaction is, well, what is that? How mm-hmm. do we fix it? Mm-hmm. How do we get the system stable again and clean? And you're right. You can take a look at the distribution that you're getting and say, all right, our future stuff depending on what you're measuring can say, are we detecting latent defects or conditions that would cause defects or stuff like that would get to the field? And we can do process capability from that and say, oh, we expect so many PPM of failures, kinds of things. It's way more complicated than that because you got to actually measure the right stuff that really does matter so you can predict it. And preventative is, I think SPC, when it's done well, you shut the line down and go figure out why that signal just happened and then fix it. And then you restart the line. You do the assessment and then you prevent future ones. It's, some people argue it's still reactive because you had to wait till something bad happened and then you go fix it. So after the fix, then it's, you know, doing the other ones. But I think the preventative piece is more mindset, is we're going to actively look for anomalies and get them out of our system. I'm thinking more of the situation I ran into was I was a hub for reliability folks across the corporation. I was kind of doing training and support and a bunch of other stuff. And it was one particular, it was a Friday afternoon. I have no idea why that always happens, but I do remember it was a Friday. And I got three phone calls that afternoon that were, we're having trouble with, it was a, like an optolinear search component, or it was some unique component. And I like, why did I, after the second one, I was like, what supplier are you using? You know, I started doing some of the, saying, what's going on with this? And the first call was just, you know anything about this? And I, no, I haven't heard anything about that. And the second call is like, I just had a call about this. What are you seeing? What symptoms? Oh, that's really similar to this other call. What vendor are you using? So I called back the first one, what vendor? Same vendor. I'm like, well, could be coincidence, you know, blah, blah. And I'm like, what's going on? And the third one called, and the first two were in consumer products. The third one was in a B2B type server type system. And I'm like, now this is just plain weird. And so I started asking more questions, but it, I didn't have anything written down or pre-planned or anything that said, if you get three phone calls on the same topic in an hour, it might be a big problem versus total coincidence. You know, and I'm a statistician, so I said, it is possible that three people would have waited to Friday to call me with something that's not urgent or anything else. But going back to them and listening to them, it was, this is going to affect our, all of our production over the last 2 months. And for consumer products, that would be a couple million products. And I'm like, this could be a real problem. And then I did have a system in place to alert lawyers, a failure analysis team, you know, the data collection, triage to figure out, you know, what other organizations are exposed by this problem. And it was all reaction at that point. But the real thing that bothered me is I didn't have a, other than just a gut feel, go, oh, I need to pull the switch on, this is a big deal versus not.
You said something critical. This could be a real problem.
Yeah.
So there was something inside of you. You didn't have data. You didn't have, but there was something there, a gut level reaction that said, three events on a Friday afternoon is anomalous. It's basically a signal to probably, maybe, not probably, maybe to something bigger. Mm-hmm. It basically kicked you into action to make this that you should do a Kappa or investigate.
Well, it was, yeah, initially it was just investigate because two things. One is if you wait, then we end up in, and I suspected that it is a type of a component that's used in a lot of electronics. And HP used a lot of electronic components. It's like that. If these three thought to call me, there's probably 20 others that, you know, didn't get around to calling me yet or won't call me, but have the same problem. And so I knew that the scope of the problem could be very large. I had no hard data, like you said, to know that. But it was just understanding electronics and understanding how our supply chain worked and stuff. Like, yeah, this could be in a lot of things. And what I gathered from those three conversations, they each had different environments, different use cases, different, you know, manufacturing sites, stuff like that. Yet they all described very similar, very few, both, all three of them only had one or two problems in the field. But then their initial failure analysis is, this is not an anomaly. This will happen to the other products too, kind of thing. And I think that then triggered, even for those groups, that was going to be a problem affecting their recent production, all of it, basically. And it was just a matter of time before the other ones would fail. And I was like, there's no good way about doing a, nothing good about doing a recall. It's, I mean, it's good business if you have to do it, but if you can avoid it, that would be great. So it was, I think it was those kinds of, that kind of thinking that said, no, I got to, and we had, a, like I said, we had a system where I could, you know, basically hit a button euphemistically sent out an email that was to a predefined team that would then go, oh, okay, we got to pay attention to this, which was nice because before that we had a problem and it took me 2 weeks to get people's attention.
So what I'm trying to do is process size this. Is there such a word? I don't know.
Well, now so there is.
You knew that this could be a problem. You had a gut level reaction, three events, anomalous events on a Friday afternoon. Could you develop a rule of thumb on that?
That's what I'm asking is, you know, it three calls in a short time frame was kind of something that was, you know, and then you start thinking it through and talking through it with other folks. And it's like, no, you get three people call you if the meeting is on schedule or canceled for next week. You know, is that reason to do the alarm bells? No, three calls alone is not the thing. There is a handful of parts. And then it became, is it volume? Is it safety? Is it this? Is it, you know, what's the cost? What's the likelihood? It just became, you know, gut feel might actually be the right thing. And it was talking to a handful of folks of how to get mm-hmm. over that. There's got to be a better way than this just smells wrong.
So right now, you know, we're a software shop and we're trying to develop a dashboard for risk management. And mm-hmm. that's where this conversation started.
Yeah. And it's, there's that key piece is when you are doing risk monitoring, mm-hmm. right? It includes what's the trigger, what separates it from, well, this is normal or just noise to, no, we got to really pay attention to this. And that's what I'm looking for in that dashboard is how do I make that step?
So we've been addressing this with, in our, you know, my daughter and I, as well as we've been addressing this with some of the security agencies mm-hmm. in the U.S., what should be a trigger for anomalous behavior or yeah. the anomalous event?
Well, there's plenty of anomalous events. It's the undesirable anomalous events, the bad events, you know, or good events too. We want to go at good stuff, but.
Yeah. So, you know, as being geeks, we started out looking at Bayesian and various other types of statistical mm-hmm. techniques. And basically, after spending almost a year looking at advanced statistical techniques, we basically went back to a heat map, just simply green, yellow, red, mm-hmm. because it's simple, it's visual, it's gut level, it's almost a gut level heuristic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we were going complex, and that was largely my bias again, and somebody who sort of reviewed our project said, you got to de-geek this stuff, Greg. I think he used a stronger word than stuff, but it starts with an S. You get the idea.
Maybe that is the geeky part in me, but if you have enough knowledge and you understand the business and what makes or doesn't make a significant event I'm drawing a blank on what you called it when it was reporting to the SEC and the for publicly traded event.
Reportable
event, yeah. And there's, as far as I can tell, there's relatively quasi vague stuff. It says, you know, if you're forecasting you're going to make 3 cents per share on this quarter and you're now making 30 cents per share on it, that's reportable. You got to tell somebody, you got to tell the SEC and your investors, or vice versa. You know, if you have a significant change to your outlook, you got to change it. And I've run into that when we have a major outbreak of field failures and it significantly changes the profitability of that organization, that's reportable. And so it's like, but I've never gotten anybody to say, what is it, you know, how much of a warranty change? Is, you know, is it a tenth of a percent or is it 200%? It's kind of a, would your investors be interested in it? kind of thing.
So here's another problem. And by the way, I don't have a solution to this. So right now, most of us very soon are going to be dealing with what's called agentic decision-making, basically autonomous decision-making. Mm-hmm. For your healthcare, for your procedure, for getting a house, for everything.
Yeah, driverless cars are now getting more and more accepted. Apparently, there's a study up in San Francisco saying they're up to, I think, 10 million rides. And so it's beyond early adopters now that people are saying, yeah, there's no driver. Okay, whatever. Let's go.
Absolutely. So, you know, what happens is for critical infrastructure, think chemical plants, manufacturing, blah, blah, blah. You're going to have these machines making decisions. Common best practice, common heuristic, it's called human in the loop.
Yeah.
But what happens if the human is the wrong person, doesn't have the background like you do, you know, for determining that on a Friday afternoon, we've got three anomalous situations or events or, you know, something's going
pointing
on.
Pointing to something, yeah.
Yeah. You know, what's that person, what's the quals, knowledge, skills, and ability of that person who's going to be doing the risk monitoring between, in these critical situations, human in the loop, agentic decision-making, critical plant decision-making. In other words, how do we replicate Fred?
Well, that'd be scary. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And even before I was, you know, the AI stuff making decisions like for autonomous driving cars and stuff like that, I did get to work with a team that did, it was a triple redundant set of sensors on, say, like a pressure vessel, and it would be much more complicated than this. But they were cautious enough and risk adverse enough that they did three different sensor technologies to, say, measure pressure. And they used three different routing of the wiring that went to the the analog to digital converters that went through three different systems and then went into three different CPUs that analyzed the information and the patterns and trends and everything, all the other info it was gathering, to say, this vessel is pressurizing too quickly and it's at risk to explode.
You need nanosecond decision making.
Yeah. And it would then shut down or mitigate or shut down or mitigate that event. And it would be very, very fast. And so, as you can imagine, is that the factory did not want that shut down unless it really, really had to be. So a false failure or false signal that said, hey, shut it down, was very, very expensive to the factory.
A false positive.
So they had to really protect against that. And equally, an even larger consequence was they really didn't want to miss it if it was blowing up a pressure vessel that had some caustic or dangerous chemicals in it. And so that kind of a situation. All of that was thought through and programmed and modeled and analyzed. And I'm quite sure they're looking at, you know, AI type systems and stuff, because it would take them quite a while to write the programming to say, right, under these sets of conditions and so on, that's the clear signal that this is a problem, shut it down. And then testing and evaluating and modeling all that stuff. But it's not like we haven't had machines making decisions in the past. It's now that it's the human in the loop is not writing the code, basically.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So back to our risk monitoring question a few minutes ago. To me, it comes down to the four Ps: being proactive, preventive, predictive, and preemptive. Mm-hmm. Because we need to have, especially nowadays, I think we just need to be a lot smarter in being able to manage the machines and manage these decisions, because otherwise these anomalous, conditions, we're not going to have a human in the loop and something's going to happen.
Well, that's where I think your dashboard and the other work you've talked to me about is how do you know that it's working? You know, so that you can trust it and walk away. Whereas you also kind of hinted at that I was the right person at the right time. you know, because I didn't have that set. Yeah. But it's getting where it's, I think the sense is the right person at the right place has the right gut feel to it. And I couldn't point to any one single element of it that said, yeah, this is a problem, but it kind of added up. And I went over and talked to my boss about it. And he's like, yeah, follow up on that. And it was, and he had even less information than I did. We only talked for like 5 minutes. And he goes, no, I think you got something there. You got to, let's deal with it. And it's harder when, as the human in the loop, if I'm not aware of or part of the get data gathering or monitoring system, and I get a report saying, hey, this might be a problem, I look at that as you still got to have a decent gut to sense what's going on to make it happen. So I guess that's the right answer, though, is that the human in the loop for our future systems, but it's also the right person, the right experience, that kind of stuff, in order to say, we got to do something about it.
I condensed the whole conversation today to three words: replicate, scale, Fred.
I'm only good for some things. I don't know.
I am being modest, Fred.
Well, you didn't see the last sourdough bread I baked. That, you know. So there's a limit to what I can be, you know, good at. But anyway, it's one of those things. I suspect in different industries this is thought through more carefully than other industries, you know. But if you're listening to this, you know, what do you think? How do you do your risk monitoring? And more specifically, how do you trigger, what triggers we got to do something with this? We need to shut down, or we need to improve, or we need to, you know, what is your preventative type trigger to go, oh, we got to do something with this? That I would be very, very interested in. And where it's successful or it's not. And all of those kinds of stories just make great fodder for future episodes to help the rest of our audience, you know, think through these things. So please do let us know what's on your mind on this, or if you've got a different question on risk management or in reliability engineering or quality, let us know. We'd love to talk about it. We're at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, where you can find a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Greg and I and the other hosts are available through LinkedIn and our about pages. So plenty of ways for you to get in touch with us. So with that, Greg, I guess we should say thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time, kind of thing.
Yeah, and I'll leave folks with one thought. If you haven't seen this movie, see 2001 Space Odyssey, because there's a great line by HAL. HAL 9000 is a computer.
Basically running the whole ship.
That's the point. And his tagline there is, I'm sorry, Dave, I'm afraid I can't do that.
Well, I remember that scene, and he's like opening the bay doors and let the guy back in the ship.
That's right. All right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thanks, Greg.
You bet.
I'll talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.